Mikroform. Der Podcast des Graduiertenkollegs Kleine Formen.
Welcome to the newest episode of our Mikroform podcast. As you can hear, this is a very special episode. Next to me, my dear colleague Morten Schneider sits. Can you tell us why we do this introduction in English?
Yes, so we're introducing a lecture given by Marche van Gelder in English. Marche van Gelder is an associate professor in early modern history at the University of Amsterdam. So she came all the way from the Netherlands to give this lecture in February of 2024. And the title was Blind Spots, Gaps and Archival Silences, Tracing Contestation in the Venetian State Archive.
And within the lecture, she basically describes how the image of Venice as a peaceful haven without protests has been purposefully constructed by state authorities in the early modern times, and traces back this image of Venice as the glorious ordered state to modes of archival suppression, such as the systematic erasure of food riots and demonstrations in the documents. She tells us the story of a mysterious death recorded in the registers, and thereby reflects also on the power of the archive and how we as scholars can approach what is not told in the documents.
This lecture was held at the Colloquium for Economic and Social History at the Humboldt University Berlin in collaboration with our own research training group on the literary and epistemic history of small forms. This meant that Marche had two different audiences with quite distinct research interests in front of her. And I was personally struck by how much effort she put into her lecture to try and bridge that gap. She really took care that both audiences had something to chew on, so I think she solved that potential problem beautifully. All in all, I found her lecture to be a very precise and very fascinating look into the methodological and ethical challenges that historians have to confront in their archival work. So, without further ado, please enjoy this lecture.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you especially to Morten and Klaas for inviting me to this combined session. I now realize actually that you're probably my home. So I've been a lapsed economic historian, or I felt like a lapsed economic historian, because that's how I started as a PhD student, mostly focused on the history of commerce and trade. I kind of pivoted towards social history and then got entangled into cultural history, and I've had an identity crisis ever since. But I think this is actually where I should be most at home, sort of in the midst of your two groups. Although I've only just realized that this is the first time that you're meeting one another, so I don't know how that's going to go, but we'll see afterwards. So like I said, I've been working for the last 10 years or so at the intersection of social and cultural history. And that's where this talk fits in. You'll see echoes of my economic historical background as well. I'm very intrigued by the concept of small forms and kind of struggled with it, especially thinking about how it relates to the gigantic mass of documentation that is the Venetian State Archive, although you could obviously argue that the archive is compiled of and consists of many, many small forms. I'm going to talk about my current book project, and here my idea is to look at how early modern power and record keeping interact with one another, and more specifically how popular protest was suppressed not just in the streets of Venice in the early modern period, but also how it was suppressed in the archive of Venice, and what that means for the way in which we've written the history of Venice in the modern period. So, perhaps as a little bit of background, Venice has a reputation as La Serenissima. It's a cliché, a commonly known one, you've probably heard of it. And La Serenissima means the most serene one, the most serene. It is probably one of the more enduring myths in European history, and it rests on the assumption that the Venetian government supplied even-handed justice and sufficient food to its subjects, who as a result never contested government power. Historians have shown, obviously, that justice was never even-handed, and also the supply of food wasn't as regular as the Venetian authorities would like us to believe. This instead, this ideal of the Serenissima is a self-image that was projected by the Venetian political elite, projected through art, through texts and books, through architecture, The Piazza San Marco that you see here is an example of that, and also through civic ritual, which represents urban society in a very ordered and regular manner. You see this very famous Gentile Bellini painting, which perhaps many of us have seen often enough, but if you think about it, it's kind of weird that you see this large procession and no public, so there's no audience at all. And that's a recurring topos, you might say, in Venetian self-representation, that you see the city, but rarely do you see the crowds in connection to examples of civic ritual. And it goes back to the projection of that Serenissima ideal. Now, whereas these grandiose claims have been debunked, the idea that Venice did not have to contend with social-political contestation still stands in current historiography. And I argue that this specific part of Venice's reputation rests on extensive archival suppression rather than on the actual absence of popular protest. Venice boasts one of Europe's largest pre-modern archives. It's among the three largest, with Simancas in Spain and the Vatican Archive for the Papal State. And it has been mined for pioneering scholarship ever since Ranke, quote-unquote, discovered it. In my work, I want to focus more on what the archive does not tell us. So by deconstructing archival gaps and silences, I want to reconstruct popular protests and collective actions, from grain riots to labor conflicts to mass demonstrations in the Piazza San Marco, so in this very space, and to invasions of the Ducal Palace, the government halls of Venice. And my goal is twofold, so I'll try to convince you that Venice was not serene, that it had to contend with protests too, and that in fact would make it the norm in pre-modern Europe. So through the work of social historians from the mid-20th century on, we now know that politics is not simply the product of kings, sometimes queens, kings, emperors, popes, etc., but that ordinary people shaped politics too, that they made the state through contestation, petitioning, claim-making in all sorts of forms. Yet Venice is still presented as outside of that norm, as the exception to the rule in overviews of pre-modern urban history, for example. And that is, in a sense, the success also of the Serenissima ideal still. And secondly, and perhaps more interestingly, I want to show that this fundamental dimension of Venetian politics, so the popular engagement with politics, has been successfully erased from the state records. Actually, it was never included in the state records, and therefore it has been excluded from history writing as well, and from collective memory. And it is this part of my work that is inspired by the so-called archival turn. So this idea influenced by philosophers and post-colonial thinkers who have highlighted the power at work in the archive, how power relations are expressed in the archive, but also how they have formed the very archive itself, and how violence, especially obviously in colonial contexts, have translated into violence on the pages, basically, of which our colonial archive consists of. So we now know that Pace Ranke, that the archive is not a mirror unto the past. We've also realized that very well-established and productive methods, such as reading against the grain, so reading, trying to understand what the original scribes and producers of the documents were not trying to tell us, but and what those words can tell a historian if you try to read against what was written, that is not enough to recover specific voices, groups, or events, specifically if there's no records left to read against the grain. So just very quickly, I focus mostly on the early modern period, so roughly between 1500 and 1700, but the way in which the archival suppression continues to work in 19th century and 20th century history, even 21st century history, especially big data projects, is something that interests me as well. Now, you probably know that Venice was not just the city itself, it was a large empire with a colonial part, you might say. So it has colonial dominions in the Eastern Mediterranean, and it occupies a large part of northeastern Italy. You can see it here, and you can also see, if you look very closely, that especially the Stato da Mar, so the Venetian Empire in the Mediterranean, became smaller and smaller as the Ottoman Empire became larger and more powerful. We're not going to focus on the Stato da Mar or on the Stato da Terra, so the Venetian mainland territories. There's loads of revolts there, very well documented, and it's an interesting juxtaposition, so that the Venetians in the metropole, so in Venice itself, recorded a lot about resistance elsewhere in their reign, but very little about revolts and contestation in the very city in which they constructed the archive. Now, the management of all these territories resulted in an enormous archive, like I said, one of the largest in early modern Europe. And today it is housed in the former convent of the Franciscan order in the heart of the city, at the Frari. It contains 400,000 archival units, roughly 80 kilometers in length. And one of the pushbacks I have gotten from various articles I've published is from reviewers that says it's such a big archive. How come something cannot be there? I mean, if you didn't find it, then it probably never happened. And that means that the archive is actually doing exactly what the producers in the early modern period wanted it to do. So you can see the photos are not incredibly clear, but you can see, especially on this side, that the government offices produced volumes, identical volumes in size and also in the bindings for their work. So for the Senate, one of the most important councils of the Republic, you have very imposing volumes as well. They're all recognizable in the sense that in the, let's say almost in the symmetry of the document as they as you see them, if you handle them, but you can also see them en masse on their modern scaffolding or depositi, that they impress upon you this sense of order. And in the words of my colleague and friend Filippo De Vivo, the Venetian archive stood as the physical repository of the government's omniscience, at once a symbol and an instrument of its efficiency. And I think this is perhaps, maybe even, I've been thinking a lot about Ranke today, but maybe also with Ranke's fixation on the Venetian archive, that has sort of continued to echo in the way in which people working on Venice, historians of Venice, have been thinking about this archive. It's very structured, it has everything, it represents the omniscience of the state. But today I'm going to try to tell you and convince you that what is not there is just as telling or perhaps more interesting for at least certain topics and themes, and in this case, a canonical theme in social history, that is collective actions and contestation. Because here I think archival gaps, and that was what was not noted down, is more telling than what is there. Now, this is important to realize that Venetian society was ordered in a very strict social legal categories. It had the form of a pyramid. So at the top, you had the patricians. They called themselves nobili, and they were roughly 8%, 10% of the entire population. And this was a well-delineated class. So if your name was written in the so-called Libro d'Oro, the golden book, that meant you belonged to the patriciate. If your name wasn't written in the book, you did not. And only the patricians could participate in formal politics. So they, men, obviously, adult men, automatically became part of the Great Council, the largest council within the Republican system. They could be elected into the Senate, one of the highest councils, and all the other councils in between. They rotated in and out of offices. They could be elected doge, the head of state. So that's the only office that you held for life. So this is a very well circumscribed political elite. Then you had a second category, second class elite, you might say, of citizens, the cittadini. And they basically were a white-collar elite. So the men from this group could occupy occupations like notary, being a notary, being a lawyer, being a secretary to all the official councils, and similar types of jobs. So it's actually this second category that does the actual production of the archive. So it's the patricians who decide, who have the political power, but it's the cittadini who are in the room as well and who produce, and in that sense have informal power as well, although they're held to certain rules and regulations in the way in which they produce the archive. So that's, let's say, 10% plus 5% is 15% of the population, and then you have the popolani, and that's the rest. And that is a big category. It is actually not a well-defined category, other than it is not, these people are not cittadini or patricians, so it's like a negative category, you might say. You can have an extremely wealthy merchant, wealthier than poor patricians, and the poorest beggar in the street, and everybody in between, all the artisans, and they're part of the popolani. And as popolani, you don't have access to formal power, obviously, and you also don't have access to the informal power of the lettered elite. I want to take you to a build where every Venetian ended up in, and it is in San Marco, so it is in the heart of the city. These are the granai, these are the grain reserves. So this is where the provisioning, where the grain and bread that Venice collects to provision its subject is kept. And you can see in the depiction that the space they occupy and the position that Jacopo de Barbari has chosen to produce this bird's eye view gives them prominence, and that echoes the importance it had in the wider state structure, obviously. Having enough bread, having enough grain in times of need is crucial to maintain social peace. And that's also why such a large warehouse is right there in the political heart and religious heart of the city. It has to do also with a religious culture of charity, but it also has very much to do with economic realities and social control, you might say. Now, the interesting thing is that the warehouses also is where the offices of the Ufficio della Sanità was, the health office. So that's the magistracy in charge of urban health, public health, who monitored epidemics, smallpox, plagues, you name it. And it's also where the clerics of all the 70 parishes that made up the city would convene every day. Whenever someone died in one of their parishes, the parish clerks were obliged to go to San Marco, walk to San Marco, and register the dead. And this then ultimately is where all Venetians convened. So it is inside the archival records of the Necrologio. This is the year 1581. And I think it's fascinating that in a city obsessed with recording and archiving, life doesn't end when you take your last breath. It ends when a scribe at San Marco writes your name and the date of your death in one of these oblong books. So regardless of status, regardless to which category you belong to in real life, ultimately you end up together with everybody else who died on that same day in the city. And these registers continue on until the death of the Republic itself. So at the end of this 18th century, when the French troops invade Venice, they continue in the same format. So in this oblong format with all these people's names written together. So I've taken a couple from this date, the 27th of November, 1581. You have at the top of the page, Swan, that's Giovanni in Venetian. Swan, son of Piero, died at birth. Lady Laura Zen, wife of Sir Alessandro Zen, 60 years, sick of fever for over a month. Maria, daughter of Swan the porter, 2 years old, sick of more than just one illness since more than 6 months. And so it goes on and on and on. They cover days, months, years, centuries, with Venetian dead. And you see that the scribes, they jot down a name, they indicate whether someone was from a noble family or not. So Lady Laura Zen, wife of Sir Alessandro Zen, they belong to the nobili, to the patricians, clearly. Maria, daughter of Swan the porter, clearly did not. That's a Popolano girl. And on and on and on it goes, with obviously infants and children crowding out the adults because of the high mortality. Now, for a small portion of the dead, the scribes added little mnemonic devices in the margin. You can see these marginalia. And they catch the eye. They catch the eye of the historian, but they obviously also were intended to catch the eye of contemporaries. And they depict the cause of death. So you have a water pot for someone who drowned, a knife or a pistol for someone who was killed, lightning bolts, swords, axes, a dog, all causes of death that was not from illness or old age, are recorded in the margin. So these images signpost sudden death. You can say these are small forms. They indicate accidents and homicides. And they have a very specific function. And my colleague Alex Bamji at Leeds has shown that these are meant to help the state monitor patterns of mortality, because they signal written words and the information we saw before, they signal whether there's a pattern in sickness. So people can trace epidemics, see where they were located, which part of the city was affected. You can keep track of homicides. It also facilitates the state's fiscal organization, so the death tax is easier to collect with necrologi that are well kept. So what you see here on these narrow pages is the state archive at work. This is a massive machine. It controls, it documents, it organizes, it surveys. And they're fascinating, obviously, for statistical research, for social research, for research into, let's say, healthscaping. So the ways in which an early modern city tried to keep its population healthy. Now, there's also another type of doodle, you might say, and that is this one. Actually, the blue V is an archivist probably early 20th century, recording and registering all the marginalia again. So what we see here is a gallows. It highlights the steps that the convict had to take towards their own death. And this gallows is next to the name of Geronimo Bon Geronimo Calafao, today hanged between the columns of San Marco at the order of the Council of Ten on 27 November 1581. And here at the picture of the gallows in the margins, I want to reflect more on the power of the archive, about what this entry tells us and what it does not tell us. It's one doodle, 16 to 17 kind of condensed words. What does it tell us about Bon? I would say a lot and at the same time very little. How does it fit into the idea of the omniscient archive, and what has it allowed historians to do and not to do? Now, we know what Bon did. We know that he was a calafao, that is calafato, that is carpenter, shipwright. So that means he was an artisan, that means he was from the popolano category. It tells us a lot, actually. But in stark contrast to everybody else on the page, to the people who surround them, we know very little, because if you go back to what we read before, the scribes were very careful to note down names, but also ages. We knew that there were young girls and an older woman of 60. They were very careful in telling us who the family members of the deceased were. We knew the father of the girl who died, and we also knew his employment, what he did. We know that Lady Laura was married, and we know to whom she was married. So in very, very few words, they gave us intricate family relations, lots of information on social and economic positions, and they also usually gave you the parish where they died. So they located these people within the larger city through the scribe's words. Here with Bon, we see nothing. We see nothing of his family relations. We don't know where he lived. We also don't know why he was hanged. And I think this is intentional. So he is isolated in a sense from the context in which he lived. We only know where he died, between the columns of San Marco. So that is right on the piazzetta, so more or less between the warehouses, which we saw before, and the Palazzo Ducale. So that is a very public place. Hanging, obviously, was a representation of the power of the state. Another thing it tells us, and that is that he was hanged at the order of the Council of Ten at San Marco. So the Council of Ten is one of the most important councils within the larger Venetian state structure. It is perhaps the most powerful council. It is in charge with keeping the public peace and securing the safety of the state. And that meant that it had the power to execute people also in secrecy without due process. And it had a lot of spies and informers throughout urban society. And it was very much feared, although obviously its power was never as great as the scary myths that surround it was. But it had far-reaching powers. They could execute people in secrecy, but very clearly here they chose a public place. And I think that is important to note too. And what I wanted to show you is that a couple of days later, they execute another calafato, another carpenter, shipwright, and that is connected. So on the 29th of November, a co-worker, you could say, of Girolamo Bon is executed as well. The fact that we have so very little information here means that we have to go to the records of the Council of Ten, and that is logical, because hanging crimes are not the purview of the Sanità, and everybody needs to record what they're obliged to record, obviously. When you go to the Council of Ten's records, you can find the order for the execution, but no mention of the crime. So there again, you get very terse wordings. You get the exact order, but you get no information on whether the person was tortured, whether they gave a deposition. Obviously, no discussions among the ten are recorded. It's just the order for the execution for both Niccolò and Girolamo, the carpenters. And I think this is a pattern. It means that neither of these deaths had any impact on historiography. They have not been deemed important. And why would they? I mean, there's a mass of documentation in the archive. You can't write about everyone. But I think there's an intention there at the hands of the ten about not underlining why they ordered them to be put to death. So I've been working a lot with non-Venetian sources, actually. I've been doing kind of the opposite of what Ranke did. So Ranke used Venetian diplomatic archives to tell a story about Europe. And I've been using European diplomats' dispatches to tell a story about Venice. Because what I noticed for another research is that diplomats based in Venice reported on a lot of forms of social and political contestation. They were writing about revolts and mass demonstrations, about armed attacks on the Ducal Palace, and about the occupation of the halls of the Collegio, and people shouting at the Council of Ten. People from the Popolani categories. And I think, although obviously all these dispatches from other diplomats have their own biases, they're not unbiased, they're not mirrors unto the past, you have to confront them and analyze them, but they tell us a story that the Venetian records do not. They tell us a story that has been sort of filtered out of the Venetian records that I've shown you here. And it's a story, in this case, about the arsenal workers. And it kind of morphs into more of an economic and social history talk here. But you have to realize that the arsenal is a massive conglomerate, a production unit. It occupies 15% of the built environment in early modern Venice. You might have visited if you've gone to the Biennale. It's still one of the most fascinating areas of the city. It ran on 10% of the Republic's annual budget, so it had a massive financial drain on the Republic's budget, and an enormous number of people worked there, mainly men, but also a significant number of women who made the sales, heavy work. And most of the workers were living very close to the arsenal here of Castello, which is a poorer area still today. Although mostly Airbnb, obviously, by now. But anyway, so it's a very specific area, and both the arsenal workers, both Calafati that we've seen in the necrology, certainly come from the arsenal community. So they were living close to their place of work, and they produced both the commercial fleet and the naval fleet of the Republic. So in essence, this is where the maritime power and the commercial power of Venice rests on, the production of ships. And it was presented to foreign visitors, foreign dignitaries, as the height of efficiency. So they ran on a production, kind of like Ford-produced cars. So it had very specific production lines for different parts of ships, which meant that they could produce galleys at very high speed. Now, economic historians have mostly looked at that efficiency part, and social historians have been mostly interested in the internal ties within the arsenal community. And both of these stories end up highlighting the supportive role of these workers, the fact that they, with their work, made the dominance in the Mediterranean of Venice possible, and the fact that there was this relationship between the elite and these workers that rested in one part on salary, although without going into too much detail, the salaries within the arsenal were lower than outside in private shipyards, but the lower salaries were compensated with the guarantee that even if there was no work, you would still get paid half a day. And that, for example, on payday, when they stood in line, so there was thousands of men standing in line and that took half a day, that half a day waiting in line was paid as well. So it's guaranteed pay even when there's no work. And when there's no work, you could obviously also go off to a private shipyard and earn money there. So it's not high salaries, but guaranteed salaries. And the other element is that this is the segment of the Popolani that are the closest to the Doge. So the highest official within the Venetian Republic, and these Popolani workers have a crucial role to play when a doge is elected. So they carry the new doge around for a celebratory round in Piazza San Marco. You can see them here, you know, strapping guys. They also carry him to his funeral when he's died. So they're there at the beginning and they're there at the end. They do hard labor. I mean, it's a very physical work. And there's three important guilds within the arsenal at work. And they also supply the men who do much of the policing within the San Marco area. So they're the only people who are allowed to carry weapons. And you can see them here keeping the other Popolani in place during a particularly rowdy celebration of a new doge. They guard the Ducal Palace. They guard the Ducal Palace during the interregnum. When one doge dies and they still have to elect another, and that takes some time, they police the vicinity of the palace, but also the inside of the palace. And they do so too when the most important councils meet. So that means that these workers are not just producers of ships, they also know the internal workings of the palace inside out. And they have access to weapons as well. There are also icebreakers when water freezes over and firefighters when fire breaks out in the city. So they're a crucial pin, you might say, in the whole machinery of the state. In that sense, historians have mostly seen them as having some sort of symbiotic relation almost with the patriciate. So the idea is that because of those roles, because of their vicinity to power, they were content with their position as popolani. And they were well trained and armed. They also did tour of duties on the Venetian fleet as soldiers, you might say, in the colonial enterprise. But they would only use that violence during these rowdy fights on the bridges, which you, if you have visited Venice, you might have seen. And these are ceremonial fist fights. Actually, people died, but it's all scripted and it's regulated in the sense that it's at certain moments in the year, at certain places in the city. And here, the patricians do not participate, obviously, they only watch. You can see them hanging from windows and on the forefront. And it's the popolani who do the fighting. But that's only one part of the story, because the two men hanged in 1581 were part of a revolt. What they did was they occupied the ducal palace. It was a time of high grain prices. And from the ducal palace, they ran to the warehouses where the grain was kept. And they plundered them and distributed the grain and the bread. So they took over, in a sense, the role of the state itself. They took over the provisioning of their co-Venetians. And it is for that offense that they were hanged, not so much for the occupation, it seems, and the revolt itself, but very much for the fact that they broke into the public warehouses of grain and that they distributed the grain and bread. And I think that might be a good place to stop as well, because I would like to hear your questions or maybe answers. I would like to go back to the start, because ultimately what I'm showing you here and what I'm telling you here is that Venice is like every other pre-modern city, whether it's Antwerp or Bruges, London or York, Barcelona, Florence, Naples or Rome, any Dutch or German city. There were occasions when the people rose up against public authorities, where they challenged the local governments, where they disagreed, usually over taxes or bread prices, and where they influenced politics, pushing back. Sometimes they succeeded in changing certain policies, sometimes they were repressed violently. Now, okay, we established that Venice is not unique, that kind of hurts Venetian historians, but I think that's healthy. But it's not the most interesting part. I think the more interesting part is, how come that people working on the social history of Venice, these are not bad historians, obviously. I mean, the social historians of Venice have uncovered a lot of interesting practices and dynamics, but not specifically how contestation functioned or even that it was there. So I think for me, it's more important how the archive plays into this, how much of that dimension of popular politics we've never seen, we've never been allowed to see, in a sense. I think this helps us understand also more in general how ideas about the power of the archive, which have been very fruitfully applied by, for example, post-colonial historians, how we can also perhaps even need to use them when we look at early modern European history. It proves that the archive is not a time machine, something that big data or digital humanities historians sometimes try to tell us. If you would connect all these archives, you cannot reconstruct Venice as it once was, because we're missing crucial gaps and specific groups and people who were intentionally left out. But it also tells us something else, I think, because if you think back to the Necrologio, so the only reason why I noticed a pattern of two, actually three arsenal workers being hanged, it is because the scribes of the Sanità did what they were instructed to do. They recorded all the dead. And in a sense, they went against what the Office of the Ten was trying to do, which was to repress a revolt, not just in the streets, but also on paper. And so I think that's fascinating, the tension between two competing offices, not necessarily competing, but between two offices, between scribes who do what they're told. One scribe condenses everything so much that you cannot understand what has happened. The other draws the doodle of the gallows to give you an idea that something did in fact happen. And I think this is a tear in the fabric, right? You can sort of see through the blanks and the gaps that have been intentionally left in the archive. And I think that opening allows you then to read along the grain to understand the specific archival culture of Venice, who's doing what and why on paper. It also allows you to read against the grain, what has been written down and the intentions that were not meant to leap out of the page. But it also can help you go back to other sources, chronicles and foreign diplomat reports, for example, to then reconstruct what happens, but also thus deconstruct the gap that you encountered in the first place. And I find that dynamic and that work as a historian more important, I think, than revisioning the entire history of Venice, although that might be a bonus too, of course. So that is for me the most interesting of this research project, the dynamics between the practices of protest, which we haven't really discussed today, and the practices of archival suppression, which has been mostly the focus here. Because I think when you combine those two, you can trace and examine how contentious politics impacted society and politics at the time, but also how they've been written out of government records, how they've never been included in our histories, and what that means actually for our memory of very influential places in European history like Venice. Thank you.
This was a recording of Marce van Gelder's lecture on blind spots, gaps, and archival silences in the Venetian State Archive. It was moderated by Morten Schneider and Klaas Oberstadt, and cut by Johann Gartlinger.
Mikroform. Der Podcast des Graduiertenkollegs. Literatur und Wissensgeschichte kleiner Formen.